Yesterday, Arthur Teal Jr., a former city commissioner in Miami, Florida, who faced federal corruption charges, walked into the lobby of the Miami Herald and shot himself in the head. The dramatic suicide came as another Miami paper detailed sordid allegations against Teal, including fraud, bribery, drug use, multiple mistresses, and male prostitutes. The story is horrific, but sadly, its roots are not all that unusual. Flash across the country to San Diego, where scandals brought down two mayors this month. There's a corruption probe in Springfield, Massachusetts, a bribery trial in Kansas City. It seems almost unfair to mention Chicago, where a Republican official recently put out a bounty for anyone who could get Mayor Richard Daley convicted of corruption. And there are more. American cities have a long history of corruption, and sometimes citizens take a perverse pride in a figure like Buddy Cianci, a flamboyant mayor, now in federal prison, but also credited with bringing the city of Providence, Rhode Island, back to life. More often, corruption involves quiet bureaucrats who loot the pension fund or take kickbacks for city contracts. Today, we want to take a look inside to ask how corruption operates in cities and how it damages and, in some cases, may improve civic life. We're also still taking your nominations for Best Summer Blockbuster Ever. Send them in to TOTN at NPR.org and then stick around as our Summer Movie Awards series begins later in the show. But first, cities and corruption. If you've been involved in local politics, have you seen corruption? Is it common? Is it easy to stop, or is it just how business gets done? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us now to tell us more about the situation in Florida is Francisco Alvarado, staff writer for the Miami New Times. He's with us from their offices, and it's good of you to join us today on Talk of the Nation. Mr. Alvarado?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. The headline on your story on Miami New Times is Tales of Teal Sleaze Stories. It must be a shock, as this story was about to come out, to have the subject of your story commit suicide.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that was the feeling I felt. I mean, shock and amazement that that Arthur Teal took his life, you know, as the paper was, you know, was hitting the stands.
Do you feel that your story had anything to do with it?
You know, I don't know if he knew the story was coming out. I don't know if he even read it, you know, had a chance to read it. The only thing I could say is if he did read it, or if he knew it was coming out, and if he knew what the contents of the article were going to be, you know, maybe it could have, you know, led to him thinking about, you know, what he was facing. Because, I mean, before the article came out, I mean, this is all, you know, information that came off a public, you know, record, you know, off documents that were, you know, released by the, you know, our local state attorney into the investigation of Arthur Teal. So, I mean, you know, I don't know, but I can say that, I mean, if he did read it and if he was feeling, you know, that he was at the end of his rope, maybe it, you know, maybe it could have been a contributing factor.
Tell us, what was he accused of?
He was charged with 10 counts of unlawful compensation by the state attorney. And that's where, you know, and that's what my article is based on. The investigation, the report, the police reports and witness interviews that the state attorney has gathered so far in prosecuting this case.
These involved payoffs, allegations of payoffs, allegations of bribes and fraud. But where did the more personal stuff, the drug use, the sex, come into it?
The investigators were interviewed one woman who admitted to having a sexual relationship with Arthur Teal. And then they also interviewed a male prostitute who is currently incarcerated in Miami-Dade County Jail, who claims that Arthur Teal was one of his clients.
Is there a culture of corruption in Miami?
Definitely.
Was he part of it?
According to prosecutors, yes, he was.
How does the Miami public view its civic government in general?
In general, I think people are dissatisfied with their government. They know that it's, you know, that there's rampant corruption, and it crosses all ethnic lines. It's not just a white issue, a black, you know, a Hispanic issue, or a black issue. I mean, we have problems with, you know, with corrupt politicians, you know, all over the place down here.
As I'm sure you know, some of Mr. Thiel's supporters have said in the aftermath of his suicide that the allegations in your story, these are investigative reports. Nothing's been proved yet. Maybe we shouldn't be publishing allegations.
Well, I mean, that's not the way the news media works, you know. I think the black community is just feeling pain, and they're lashing out in reaction to what they think, you know, has been, you know, a slight on Mr. Thiel. But the fact remains is that, you know, reporters, we follow public corruption cases all the time, you know, and whenever documents are released, you know, we're running to be the first ones to publish it, because, you know, again, these are public documents, and, you know, and most of the time, there's corroborating statements in these, you know, in these type of stories that, you know, that that at least we write. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time. Francisco Alvarado is a staff writer for the Miami New Times, and he joined us from that newspaper's offices in Miami, Florida. Joining us now here in Studio 3A is Stephen Goldsmith, a professor at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, director of their Innovations in American Government program. He served also two terms as the Republican mayor of Indianapolis from 1992 to 1999. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
As we've seen in the case of a former Miami City Commissioner, the power of the press can be an influential power in exposing government fraud.
Absolutely. I mean, today, story is obviously tragic for a number of reasons, but City Hall's had 50 or 75 years of kind of or more of a troubled history in this country with bold and honest leaders, but also these episodes of corruption, and a bright light from the media moves people the right direction. So in general, it's has a therapeutic effect, but often a tragic one as well.
Mm-hmm. Miami-Dade County government has a new corruption czar. Is that common, that kind of investigative body?
Well, that's uncommon, but, you know, I spent 12 years as a prosecutor prosecuting public corruption, then I was in City Hall. And, I mean, you have, I think we need to probably sort out for a second corruption from patronage. They can go together. They're not necessarily the same thing. When you get over into corruption issues, you have state's attorneys, prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, inspectors general, lots of apparatus set up to handle those sorts of things. They generally operate as they should. Question is the kind of prophylactic one. How do you prevent this stuff? How do you create a culture that's so ingrained with honesty that you reduce? You can never be sure you eliminate it. And so whether you call it a czar or, you know, Miami, for example, has a strong, honest mayor who's trying to set a culture, I think, Mayor Diaz as well. So it's a mixture of tools, and some cities do some things and some do others.
You talked about a distinction between patronage and corruption. Patronage is just giving jobs to your supporters.
Right. I mean, there are times, there are extensions of patronage that become abuses, but I'm differentiating from every city at the top level. Obviously, the mayor hires folks, hopefully, who are skilled, but obviously who agree with his or her agenda. You can have patronage that goes down lower in the ranks, which feels like what we had in the Tammany Hall days, where you're hiring friends and buddies for all the wrong reasons, but they still may be honest people just hired for the wrong reasons. But that tends to create, unfortunately, if it's pervasive, a culture of kind of anything goes or rules don't count, which then can bleed over to corruption where the state's attorneys get involved.
If you worked in city government, if you've had some experience with this, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Kevin. Kevin giving us a call from Kansas City, Missouri.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I happen to be chief of staff of the mayor here in Kansas City back in the early 90s, when there was several city council people indicted for various different deals. It's very interesting what happens inside the culture of City Hall when the rumors start flying that there is a grand jury investigating such and such, there's a grand jury investigating such and such. And I think it was about four city council people, and there was only 12 city council people and the mayor ended up getting indicted.
So that's a third of the city council. That's a pretty substantial number.
And especially in a city manager form of government, where there is not a strong mayor form of government, meaning that the mayor doesn't control the patronage or doesn't control, the police department, doesn't control who's city manager controls all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
It was all in every case, in every instance, it was about money.
It was about. I was going to ask what it go back to. Was it just greed or?
Well, it was. Yeah, it was money and people attempting to do favors, whether it be for a developer or for a friend, et cetera. But there was in a couple of cases it was legitimate. In a couple of cases, I think it was overreaching by the prosecutor. But anyway, some people ended up having to plead guilty to lesser charges.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I think the caller makes two really interesting points. One is that we established over a number of years these professional apparatus in City Hall, and he mentions a city manager, where the city manager has authority, the mayor often doesn't. The idea is that insulates you against graft. Obviously, that's not the case. The second is when he says maybe the prosecutor overreached. What it suggests is the second, I think, interesting observation on the caller's part, which is that often if you have people doing things that aren't really corrupt but don't feel right, the lines become gray, and then a prosecutor may redraw the line. But what that suggests to me is that you need to have a set of elected officials and an enforcement apparatus internally that draws those lines for you, because otherwise your employees will. We see things with vehicle towing. We see things with code inspectors. We see lots of stuff in the old days with police officers. And I think it's a combination of tools, and those bright lines help an awful lot.
Kevin, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
We're talking about cities and corruption. Who gets swept up into it, and is it always damaging? What's the story where you live? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN, at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Yesterday's suicide of a Miami politician under investigation for fraud and corruption joins a long list of lurid scandals from our nation's cities. The villains range from fed-up bureaucrats to beloved city fathers, and the results can be everything from a rotten infrastructure to a revitalized local economy. Cities and corruption is the talk of the nation today. If you've worked in local government or had another reason to run into its unseemly side, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest here in the studio is Professor Stephen Goldsmith, Director of Innovations in American Government Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And let me ask you, Professor Goldsmith, do things sometimes get done because there's corruption? You cut out the bureaucracy, get rid of the red tape?
I thought your when you opened, I thought that was an interesting observation. But I don't think I want to go there in this sense. It is true that if you create a highly centralized, professionalized organization, that often means a resilient bureaucracy that operates on its own schedule, and that schedule is very slow. So you can see people push around the edges for good reasons. They want to do something. They want to build something. They want to solve a neighborhood problem.
Got to revitalize that waterfront.
They want to revitalize the waterfront. Now, that rule bending, I would say, although for the right reasons, is a very different issue than corruption. So I think we ought to distinguish here. Rule bending, moving around the bureaucracy, trying to operate because a mayor or a city official wants to accomplish something good, maybe something gets done because of that. But when you move over past that to kickbacks and corruptions and bid rigging, I don't think that produces a good result, and I don't think that's healthy for the city. Some people can claim that that's why they're doing it, but generally we find corruption is for the reason you mentioned in the first part of the show. People are after money. They're greedy.
And even even with the best of intentions, once you start bending rules in one place, it gets to be a habit, doesn't it?
Well, it's right. The reason for the rules are that people know what's right and what's wrong, and there's clear lines. And if you bend the rules, it becomes a habit, and habits can lead to exchanges of money, and then you have the wrong message being sent out.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Jim. Jim calling us from Redding, California.
Hi, how are you this afternoon? I wanted to call. I've experienced about 20 years of work in local governments, working with city councils, mayors, city managers, primarily dealing with land use issues. And I think your speakers are making some excellent points. I think little, if any, corruption in that period of time, but I've seen a significant amount of influence peddling. And I think the relationships that politicians make with business leaders, those types of things, work both to the benefit and to the detriment of the community. Experienced it many times that the rules, I think the euphemism is, are flexibly applied to gain some other goal.
When you say influence peddling, Jim, what do you mean? Give us an example.
Well, I think, for example, an individual who is elected to a council seat, who is also a member of local groups, rotaries, things like that. They spend much time together. They accomplish many, public projects together and those types of things. That provides access and a perspective that is, based on those relationships. So many of these things are common in business. When they get into government, I think the tone becomes a little bit different and the implications of it become a little different.
And Stephen Goldsmith, is this relationship due to, well, obviously the politicians once in office have access to hand out city money one way or another in contracts, but of course they want to get reelected too, and maybe somebody's going to donate some money.
Well, yeah, money has a place. Legal money has a place, but first of all, I think we have a lot of gray in the middle here, right? Mm-hmm. It's pretty easy to see the out and out corruption. What this caller is raising is kind of the set of informal relations that academics used to call kind of the civic elites, those groups who got together and decided what was in the city's best interest, and often that was in their best interest as well. But many of those civic elites were in it for the right reasons. So, and then you move over to the area of campaign contributions. And I think, although there's a legitimate school of thought about the good and the bad of campaign contributions, I think for today's discussion is, say, if things are done in the bright light of day and they are disclosed, although there may be positive and negative effects of that, that's really a lot different than the stuff that you've been talking about today, which are kickbacks and handouts and people, in San Diego allegedly passing ordinances because they've received money under the table, if you will, from vested interests. And all in all, I guess, I have two reactions to this. One is a district attorney, one is a prosecutor. As a district attorney, nothing should be a district attorney, and one is a mayor. One is a district attorney, nothing should be tolerated. The other is a mayor saying, look, if you create a city that's run by bureaucracy, then you tend to lose the popular effect of an election where you want things changed. So it's a give and take in the middle.
Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
Until yesterday's shocking news from Miami, San Diego, you mentioned. San Diego had the most recent claim to the scandal spotlight. Phil Lavelle is a politics writer for the San Diego Union-Tribune who's been covering the merry-go-round of mayors in that city. He joins us now from the newspaper's offices in San Diego, and it's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil. Glad to be here.
Now, how many mayors have you had this month?
Well, we keep getting that question. We've had three. Mayor Murphy resigned effective July 15th, and his handpicked successor from the city council, Michael Zucchet, was to take over in his absence. But before he could chair his first city council meeting, he was convicted in federal court of corruption charges, and so he was gone. And now we've got the third mayor. Councilwoman Toni Atkins is filling in as mayor pro tem until we conclude the results of our mayoral runoff election November 8th. We had a primary this Tuesday. So we're getting close, but we've had three in a short span.
And as I understand, those two mayors fell due to two different scandals.
Well, Mayor Murphy was boxed in by a fiscal scandal, a financial scandal involving the pension system, which has a deficit of at least $1.4 billion due to years of underfunding and also unfunded benefit hikes, which some believe were handed out for political reasons. And there was also a recall movement just sort of gearing up. And he had lost a lot of his political support because last year, Councilwoman Donna Frye was a write-in candidate, and there were more ballots with Frye's name on them, but more than 5,000 of them were tossed out because the bubble hadn't been filled in on these computer scanning ballots. So the courts threw that out. She would have been the mayor had those ballots been counted. So he was weakened considerably, and the financial scandal is still underway. We have a federal grand jury investigating irregularities related to the pension system underfunding, and the Securities and Exchange Commission is also investigating possible securities fraud related to the city's evident failure to be fully truthful with investors in the city's bond portfolio. So you've got the SEC, the FBI, United States Attorney are still out there, and there's a strong belief that a strong likelihood of indictments sometime between now and perhaps the fall.
It's a little hard to remember that San Diego was once touted as America's cleanest city.
Yeah, well, we have, I think in California, we have a reputation for clean municipal governance, and it goes back to the progressive movement in the 1930s, which gave us a number of things, actually, prior to that. But our city charter came along in the early 1930s. We have pretty good campaign finance laws, or we thought that we did. But San Diego has a pretty low tax base. People out here don't like to be taxed, but the citizens have high appetites for public services, and also over the years, various mayors have also had their appetites. We had the Republican National Convention in 1996 to pay for stadium expansions, all sorts of things. And so in the mid-1990s, they started underfunding the pension system as a way to free up cash every year for their operating budgets. Nobody really noticed as the stock market in the late 1990s boomed and kept the asset levels high. People didn't really notice the damage this was doing to the pension system. Then the markets corrected in 2000 through 2002, and then boom, all of a sudden we realized we have these huge deficits. And it's alleged that some members of the former pension board engaged in a quid pro quo. In other words, they blessed the continued underfunding of this system in exchange for benefit hikes. So it's kind of a double whammy, putting less money into the system but boosting benefits. And six of them have been charged with felonies by the district attorney, felony conflict of interest.
Now, the turnout in the mayoral primary election this week was 44%. Does that tell you anything about voter interest in city government?
Well, actually, that's not bad.
That's
if you look
high,
at the turnout in Los Angeles, it's not bad for this time of year. In the Los Angeles mayor's race, the turnout was about 30%. You have to remember this is the middle of the summer. A lot of people are on vacation. People are thinking about going to the beach or going to, having a barbecue or something. And so considering that the time of the year and the fact that this is a special election, that's not a bad measure. In the presidential election, in which our mayor's race was on the ballot last November, turnout here was around 70-75%, which is pretty good. So I think there is a pretty strong voter interest, and there's also strong voter unease with politics here in San Diego. There was a poll that came out the day before the election on Monday that the pollsters said the civic mood is decidedly grim. 73% of those polled, and these are voters in San Diego, said the city was on the wrong track.
Phil Lavelle, thanks very much. At least the weather's still good.
Thanks, Neil.
Phil Lavelle, a politics writer for the San Diego Union Tribune, and he joined us from the newspaper's offices in San Diego. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Bill. Bill calling us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Yes, Neil, I appreciate your program. Always enjoy it.
Thank you.
I learned politics, city politics, from an inner-city neighborhood where back in the early 70s, we were really upset with the kind of services that we got and how we were treated, and got very close to elected officials from the neighborhood level and tried to get them to listen to what our problems were and solve our problems, and began to realize that our government in Grand Rapids was designed in the reform movement back in the early teens and 20s when all over the United States there was a lot of corruption in city government. And so they set up as a model the council manager form of government, where you have a council that's elected by the people and a management that's hired by those elected people. So the council doesn't touch any money. The council sets policies. The council oversees the kind of services, listens to the complaints, and makes sure that the system works. And all the time that I worked from the neighborhoods, I can remember putting enough pressure on some city commissioners that I was actually at their house in the morning when they were shaving and saw them as they went home at night at the end of meetings. So I got really close to it, and then I got elected and served on the Grand Rapids City Commission for 2 terms and have been off now for a couple of terms, about 8 years off, but still have stayed close to the system. And I think the council manager form of government works very well in this town.
Bill, thanks very much. We're talking about corruption, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Professor Goldsmith, I get a response to that.
Well, just a really quick response, because I think it's actually a fascinating point because it kind of frames the issue for us today. It's true that the progressive era of government that leaves to these city managers can reduce corruption, but over the last 10 years, what we've seen in the country, as cities, particularly large cities, reach tough times, they've moved from city manager forms of government back to strong mayors, because it's the connection between being the top elected official and the top reformer in your city that allows you to accomplish things. And the trade-offs here are the more rules you have and the more tightly organized you are with respect to following those rules, often the slower it is to get things done. The issue, I think, for us today is to find ways that people can operate honorably and get more done. And I'm not so sure that for all cities, the city manager form of government is the best one. There's much less corruption today than there used to be, but there's obviously way too much still.
Mm-hmm. Bill, thanks, by the way, very much for the phone call. I was just about to ask you, he's obviously talking about one thing that he believes is a structural aid to do this, but isn't this a societal? I mean, again, corruption is always going to be with us. I'm not sure that it's any worse today than it ever has been in the past. There's just a lot of it seemingly around just at the moment. But what is going to take to get cleaner government? You're never going to get rid of it all.
Right. I really do think, I mean, this is a really bad month for city governments. Mm-hmm. But overall, I don't think anybody would disagree that government today is much cleaner than it was 50 years ago. Yet society is more willing, whether you look at corporate excesses or otherwise, there's a lot of failings going on. What we need is the things you've already pointed out, an informed and committed electorate, political officials to take their jobs in order to improve the city, active prosecutors, and most importantly, inside city government, internal auditors, inspector generals, and other devices that say to those who work there that this conduct won't be tolerated.
See if we get another caller on the line. Alex in San Antonio, Texas.
Neil?
Yes.
Hey, Neil, thank you very much for putting me on the show. Great
sure.
show.
Thank you.
Hey, Neil, I had a comment regarding corruption with government. In my opinion, and I know another caller emphasized this, voter turnout, I honestly think the reason we have corruption in our government is because you have such low voter turnout. People, it just, in my opinion, don't really seem to really care. If you take a poll, or if you take a sample size of people out there, I would dare say that at least half of them do not know who their representatives or their senators are in Congress and in the White House. People don't care. And when you have that type of, attitude from citizens, as an elected official, why should you care? Why should you worry about, taking bribes? I mean, I would say the last 2 presidential elections, okay, I'll say that they were built up, but on average, on your local governments, county, city, state, 30% of the voter, that's basically, that is your boss as an elected official. You answer to 30% of the public, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, I mean, why should you care? Why?
Stephen Goldsmith, let me ask you about Alex's point. Obviously, citizen involvement, voting is a measure of interest here.
Voting is a measure of interest, and the more people at the vote, the more likely are you are, I think, to have an accountable government. The more transparency you have, the more procurements that are done online. There's lots of ways to encourage this. I have this kind of I'm ill at ease, though, because, you know, you call me professor, but at heart I feel like I'm a mayor, and I feel like I'm kind of under attack here. So I think we should probably point out, you know, yesterday I had 3,000 people for a lunch on innovations in government. These are committed public servants, and it's true that today, without the public watching, without transparency, it's easy for people to abuse their offices. And so the goal should be to create a culture of service. And the voter pressure creates that, but also the internal standards that somebody who's elected can accomplish as well. And we just have to get that calibration right.
Alex, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Professor and Mayor Goldsmith, we thank you very much. Stephen Goldsmith served 2 terms as mayor of Indianapolis. He's now a professor at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, directs their Innovations in American Government program. When we come back from a short break, the Talk of the Nation Movie Awards. What gets your vote for best summer blockbuster of all time? We'll find out right after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.